Good evening, and welcome back to our final lesson of the world of Kabbalah, Lesson 6. And tonight, we are discussing the essence of everything. Yes. You could just hit the number 1 on the screen. You don't have to go all the way to the door. We're very advanced here. Thank you. So, we are going to open, as we have for the last 5 lessons, with a chapter of Psalms, which I will read. And I'll ask everyone to read after me. We'll do 1 or 2 words at a time. I'm going to read Psalm 121. If possible, if we can get 2 seats together for this wonderful couple. I see a bunch of individual seats. Sure. Wonderful. Thank you for accommodating. We're going to do Psalm 121. And we'll keep in mind all of the hostages, that they should all be released and returned to their families safe and sound. We'll also think of all the members of the IDF who are protecting the people of Israel with their very lives. They should all be successful in their mission and return home. And peace for all Jews in Israel and around the world. Just repeat after me. Shir lama'alot, Esa einai, El haharim, Me'ayin, Yavo Ezri, Ezri, Me'im Adonai, Ose, Shamayim Va'aretz, Al Yitain, Lamot Raglecha, Al Yanum, Shom Recha, Hine, Lo Yanum, Velo Yishan, Shomer Yisrael, Adonai Shomrecha, Adonai Tzilcha, Al Yad Yiminecha, Yomam Hashemesh, Lo Yakeka, Viareach Balayla, Adonai Yishmarcha, Mikol Ra, Yishmor, Et Nafshecha, Adonai Yishmar, Tzeitcha Uvo Echa, Me'ata, Ve'ad Olam. The Lord will guard your going and your coming from now and for all time. Amen. So great to see everybody for lesson number 6 of the world of Kabbalah. And I know throughout the last 5 lessons, we went in between the lofty, the esoteric, the practical, the personal, a lot of esoteric, and we can look forward to a lot more of that tonight, and we'll soon see why. So, if you recall, in previous lessons, we talked about what was known in Hebrew as Or Ein Sof. Anyone know what that means in English?
Infinite light.
Excellent. Great group. Wonderful. The infinite light. So the infinite light, as we already established, is not God himself. It's the infinite light, the light of God. We talked about how light emerges from a source. That means that the light, the infinite light, is not the source. It's coming from a source. The source is God himself. So, we explained as well that this Or Ein Sof, this infinite light, is one of God's manifestations. And it's an infinite manifestation of God. Or the manifestation of infinitude. Now, I love the concept of infinity. I can talk about it all day, or forever, actually. But there's something even greater than infinity. We're going to go beyond infinity. Did you ever think that's possible? Infinity is like, that's the ultimate. Well, the infinite light is infinite. That's already infinity. And the light implies that there's also a source. So today, tonight, in our final class, we're going to go to the source of the infinite light. That means beyond the infinite. And we'll soon see how that's possible to even talk about what does beyond the infinite even mean. But for starters, talking about the infinite light, what was the Hebrew term for it? We just said, or Ein Sof. So, if you want to be a little more literal, what do those words mean exactly?
Without ending.
The light that has no end, exactly. Or Ein Sof, the light that has no end. Why do we call it the light that has no end? Why don't we say the light that has no beginning or end? So, for the same reason, because does it have a beginning?
Yes.
It does. We can't say this light doesn't have a beginning. The light comes from God. It comes from God Himself. If that's the case, then it has a beginning, but it's infinite. It doesn't have an end. So that's why we call it precisely that. Now there are other things in creation which are similar, that have a beginning but don't have an end. Can anyone think of something? Not quite within our realm right here, at least not our visible realm, but angels. If you think of angels didn't always exist. They have a beginning. They were created. We talked about, anyone remember which of the worlds the angels hang out in? That's way too high. The angels are already creations, so they have to dwell where creation begins. Bria is the first location, so to speak, where you'll find an angel, because Bria is where creation begins, where independence begins. That's where angels begin. So there are some in Bria, there are some in Yetzirah, and there are some in Asiya as well. But the spiritual part of Asiya, we're in the physical part of Asiya. So yes, that is true. So angels are just an example of something. Good evening, Debbie. Angels are an example of something where that have a beginning because they were created, but they have no end. Angels don't have an expiration date. They don't have a body. They don't expire. They don't die. They live forever. So that's another example. What's that? Correct. Yes, the soul. That is true. Although, yes, we can say the same about the soul. Even though it could be the soul, which is a piece of God Himself. If God always existed, then the soul may have also always existed. Because a soul is even greater than an angel, as we know. We're God's chosen, when we go beyond the purpose that God has in angels, God has in us. And we'll kind of touch upon that at the end. So if that's the case, then souls also really, really like God, don't have a beginning. So we'll leave it at that for now. Let's just jump in here with text number one. How about we start with Kim, and we'll read this reading on this topic of no end versus no beginning. Please take it away on page 177.
We refer to God's light as in soft without end instead of in lo
tzalicha. Tehillah.
Without a beginning. This preference appears puzzling because essentially there is no difference. Anything that has no beginning also has no end, as is known. The truth is that if we intend to refer to God's very essence, it would indeed be appropriate to use the phrase in lo tzalicha, without a beginning. However, what we describe as in soft is in fact God's light or radiance and not God Himself. To clarify, when the Kabbalists speak of or in soft, their intention is the endless light of God, not the light of the endless one. They're not attempting to describe the origin of the light as endless, for we cannot describe God Himself as endless.
Thank you. So, we have Or and Sof, which is the light with no end. It has a beginning, so it is not truly infinite. And what is truly infinite? Where does the light come from? Get used to this word. because we're going to be talking about it a lot. The word of the day is Atzmut. You may hear me say Atzmus with an S at the end, as opposed to the Atzmut. It means the same thing, though, believe me, and it means the essence of God. Tonight, we're going to the essence of it all, beyond everything that we've discussed up until tonight. And the word, the definition of the word is the essence of God from which all else emerges. So, everyone have that word down pat?
How can we not describe him as endless if he's endless?
It doesn't make sense
because it's not enough. You mean God?
Yeah.
Because that falls short of describing him. An angel is also endless. God is not just endless. He's also beginningless. So it would be falling short. It would be compromising who he is if you just called them endless. The light you can call endless, but the light comes from God, so it goes beyond the light. And the source, which is Atzmut, the essence, has no beginning and no end either. So to use a term of only no end would be a disservice. So basically we arrived at the ultimate, which is the essence of it all. And that's what we're going to be discussing tonight. And it's a little bit difficult. And that's because whatever we can say about Atzmut is really only what it isn't. We don't really have what to say as far as what it is, because it's beyond everything. So it's beyond definition, beyond description, and beyond articulation. But we could say what it isn't. So it's going to be a little difficult, but nonetheless, we're going to do our best. And how about we, Jacob, if you're okay reading text number 2, please, on this topic.
Every title is a description, an attempt to describe something about a particular entity. It follows that a recipient of the title is an entity with a degree of definition or limitation that lends itself to description. Now, none of this is true of God's essence. We are left without any form of name or title by which to refer to him. Our knowledge of Atzmut is limited to the fact that he creates. Consequently, we have no way to refer to Atzmut other than to describe him as creator.
Thank you very much. So because there is no name that would do justice to Atzmut, we're going to speak only of the essence, either in English or Atzmut in Hebrew. And we are going to we are going to do our best and try to, I'm not going to say define, because we're not going to be defining, but we're going to be discussing various components with which we can somehow get a concept of what the Atzmut and essence of it all is. So what we have to realize is that all the way from the bottom, from the worlds of Bria, Yetzira, Asiya, all the way up till the infinite light, all of that, well, not really all. I take that back. Once we talk about the three worlds of Bria, Yetzira, Asiya, those are worlds. That's already where there's independence. Beyond that, Atzilut, Keter, and the infinite light, that we could use the term godliness, as we've discussed earlier. Godliness means not God, but godliness. And the infinite light is godliness. It's just not God himself. But tonight, we're going beyond that. We're going from godliness, and we're going to talk about God, the essence of it all. Now, no description can contain Atzmut, and we're going to you're going to notice that in your book, you're going to have figure 6.12, etc., throughout the whole course. And we're going to be talking about different components with which we could get some type of concept of what the essence of it all is that we really ultimately have no clue about. But we're going to be discussing some ideas. Okay, the first one is, as you see on 179 and 6.1, number one is has no definition whatsoever. It means that it's beyond everything. And it's not, you know, we shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that we were following this map that some of you have in front of you. Wonderful. It's not that we're going on this ladder from the bottom all the way up and now we reach the top. That would be mistaken to view it this way. yes, up until now we were talking about maybe more spiritual and more spiritual and more spiritual, so it kind of makes sense to kind of view it as beyond, and this beyond that and that beyond that. When it comes to the essence, it's everywhere and nowhere at the same time. It's not like it's on top of everything else on a map. So we shouldn't view it that way. Now, how do we separate? How do we separate and distinguish the essence from everything else? Or at least one of the ways. So one of the ways is, and Maimonides, I believe, uses these terms first. And he uses the following terms. In Hebrew, it's efshari hamitziyot versus michuyav hamitziyot. But I'm going to translate. Efshari means possible. That it's not what it means here, though. Everything other than the essence of God himself, everything that exists is contingent on something else. Everything that's here is because of something. And that's true about everything that's in the world, meaning something existed that brought about that thing. So anything that's here is here contingent on something else. And if that something else wasn't here, then the next thing wouldn't exist. So everything is contingent. The only thing that isn't contingent, meaning it's absolute, is God himself. The essence of God himself is the only thing within existence that exists absolutely. Which means that even if nothing else exists at all, anywhere, on any level, God would still exist. He's not here because of something else. Everything else is here because of him, or because of whatever system he put in place. So, but the only thing that is an absolute existence is God himself. To translate it kind of a little more closely to the word of Maimonides, the only thing that's like a necessary existence. Everything else is contingent on other things. God himself is a necessary existence. And he, in other words, an existence that must be. And therefore he has no cause. Everything else is caused by something else. God isn't caused by something else. So figure 6.2 takes us to this idea that God, the essence of God, is the only entity that necessarily exists. Are we getting some concept here of what this means? Atzibut is an existence that must be and has no cause. I'm trying to think of some way to illustrate this. But, I think it speaks for itself. So, do we get the idea, the difference in between contingent, right? Everything that we know is here because of something else, right? A house is here, first of all, because we need it, and it's made up of materials that we built it from. And those materials come from something else, etc. Everything is here because of something else. The only thing that's not here because of something else is God. God always was, right? I know it's hard for us to kind of imagine in that direction. But if you even to say that God existed before creation, the term before can't even be used, because with creation, God also created time. Time was created with creation. It's one of the creations. But God exists beyond, whether there would be creation or no creation, he would exist regardless. Nothing made God exist. God always did and always will exist. Okay, so that's point number two. Any question? I don't either have questions on that. We're all in the same boat. Again, we're trying to get some semblance of a concept of the essence of it all, and we're going to do our best. But believe me, we're all on in the same boat here. So let's go to the next component about the essence of God, and this is going to get a little more interesting. So, Atzmut, God in his essence, is bound by no rules whatsoever. Okay, everything else has rules. Meaning, once there's systems put in place, then everything has rules. There's rules of physics, there's rules of nature, and there's programs and systems. The only thing that doesn't have any rules is God himself, because he created all the rules, right? Anyone have a favorite game here? A game has rules, right? But it's possible for the rules to have been different. If whoever made the game could make the game a little bit differently and change the rules of the game. So they don't have to be. They're not absolute. They were created and put in place in this way. Those rules of that we're familiar with, kind of within rules of a game or whatever, all those things could be changed. They're all creations. However, when it comes to Atzmut, when it comes to the essence of God, then over there it's a different story. Because the rules that God put in place, God created these rules, and he could have also created different rules. Let's try to illustrate this a little bit. So, we're going to start with this. We will start with this. By the way, did we say a joke in the beginning? I think we need one tonight. So apparently a yeshiva opened once in Orlando, Florida. And on the first day, the rabbi gets up in front of the yeshiva and he says, nobody's ever allowed to be caught going to Disneyland. If you do go, the first time you're caught, it's a $50 fine. The second time, it's a $500 fine. The third time, it's $1,000. He let it sink in and he asked the group, any questions? And one boy raised his hand and he said, what's the cost for a season pass? So that's as far as the rules are concerned. Let's talk about it this way a little bit. You know what? Let's read text number 3. It's a short one. Debbie, would you like to read that? On page 184.
In truth, even infinity does not express absolute, whether God's essence is neither finite nor infinite. The qualities of infinity and finitude apply exclusively to divine revelation.
Thank you. So this is going to be a little bit of a tough one, but nonetheless, it's a truth. When we say that God is the essence, we mean to say that God goes beyond the infinite as well, as we said before. What does that mean, that God goes beyond the infinite? It means that to say that, like, our world is finite, but God is infinite, if we say that God is infinite and not finite, that would be like limiting God. We can't put God in any box. We can't even put him in the box of the infinite. Because to say that God is only infinite would be limiting God from the finite. Anyone following me? In other words, when it comes to God himself, when it comes to the essence, infinity and the finite are both equal before God. Just like being finite is a definition for God, being infinite is also a definition for God. So you can't say that he's only infinite and not finite. Following my line here? So that's, what's that?
No, I'm not following. In the infinite world, at least in the physical infinite world, to use that term, it includes finite. So finite is a small part of infinity. It has boundary, but infinity has no boundary.
What do you mean that finite is a part of infinity? What is infinite? Like,
I don't know what's infinite other than God. Okay.
So let's just say the infinite light that we've been talking about. Okay. Not the essence of God, but God's infinite light.
Why wouldn't the essence of God also be part of infinity or infinite?
It is infinite, but it's also finite.
finite is a component of infinite.
It's not a component of infinite. If something has the definition of infinite, it's not finite. Yes?
Since if God created time, and infinite and finite are all relative to time terms, then you're sort of having to say that God has to be beyond those, because you're then defining God in terms of the creation, which is time.
Yes, yes. God is beyond, he has to be beyond both. Let's just say, for example, the infinite light of God, which is infinite. But is that infinite light able to be integrated into our reality right here? And we've kind of touched upon this in earlier classes.
The infinite light is around us and way outside of us.
But why is it only outside of us? Why isn't it apparent? Why wouldn't you be able to identify it? Just like you could identify the fact that you're alive, right? We know that we are alive, our body is alive, because our soul is vitalizing our body. In other words, there's vitality within us that fits, that's aligned with our brain, with our heart, with our arms. So that's like the integrated energy. But there's also a more infinite energy. I used the body as an example, but coming back to reality as a whole, there is an infinite light which we spoke about in earlier classes, but it's not apparent, and it can't be integrated because it's defined by being infinite. If it's infinite, it can't marry finitude. It has to hover from a distance. It can't be integrated within reality because it's defined by its infinite nature. If it would be able to be captured, it wouldn't be infinite. It would become finite.
There are concepts.
And that's why we had the Tzimtzum, by the way. But go on.
I don't know that I understand. You'll be able to explain this much better than I can. But there are concepts that everything that has been created is also containing a piece of God. This pen, this cup, a blade of grass.
Let's say divine energy, yes.
But those things are also finite.
And
so
the energy
within the infinite.
And the energy that's in the blade of grass is also a finite energy. It's not an infinite energy. We spoke about the difference earlier between sovev and mimale. Those are identifying terms for two different types of divine energy. Mimale is the one that fills the world or a specific creation and is kind of tailor-made to the needs or to the nature of that particular object. Sovev is the energy that can't be integrated in a inner way, and that's why it has to remain sovev. It remains distant and it hovers from above. So all those things that you're identifying, they do exist because they have divine energy, but not infinite energy. It has an energy that's tailor-made to it. It's finite.
Yeah, the bottom line for me is it finites, anything that's finite is within the infinite. It's still finite. The infinite is not finite.
Well,
the infinite has no boundaries.
You're right that everything in reality also receives energy from the infinite light, but not in an integrated way.
I don't want to stop you from going on.
Let's see what happens. Let's continue going. So, when it comes to God Himself, does it make sense to anybody here that when we say that we can't put God in a box of infinity, just like we can't say He's finite, we also can't say He's infinite, because that's putting Him in one and not the other. So God is as capable within the finite realm as He is within the infinite. He's both. He created both of them, and He can move around among both as He finds sees fit.
So is He amorphous?
What's that?
Is He amorphous?
Meaning?
That there's no, he can have a boundary or not.
Exactly. Yes, he could choose to put himself in a boundary. He could choose to not put himself. Like we said before, he created the rules, and he could do what he wants with the rules. So any system that we know of, God created it. So he's not bound by the system. Think of there are certain, let's say there's a kindergarten teacher who sits, gets down on the floor and plays with a student. So that's one type of relationship. Then you have another professor of something who is very comfortable in his field, but maybe incapable of talking about whatever his field is with anybody else. He's very limited to his capacity, even though he's brilliant. Even though he may have come up with some exceptionally brilliant ideas, but he has no capability to be able to communicate these ideas to anyone other than people who are in his field. And then you could have someone who's even greater than that professor, who has the ability to communicate about it with people in his own field and also be able to communicate with children in some way about this idea. In other words, if a professor is limited to his own realm, then then he may be brilliant, but he has a very strong limitation too. Only someone who could do both is that individual goes beyond both. Now, I'm not sure that this is so common, but when it comes to God, God can exercise his abilities both within the infinite and in the finite. But let's advance to some other points. Maybe this will become a little clearer. So, because God created the rules, God could also suspend them. And there's actually a fascinating manifestation of this that existed within the temple, within the Holy Temple, when it stood in Jerusalem. And let's get to know this idea. So first of all, this term of Nimna HaNimnaot means, Nimna means something is impossible. Okay, so for example, I am Nimna from jumping from in front of the building. I can't jump from the ground to the roof of the building. It's impossible for me to do that. To say that anything is impossible for God is an impossibility. You can't say that anything is impossible for God. That's what this term Nimna HaNimnois means. It is impossible to ascribe an impossibility to Atzmo.
This is an old did God create a rock so heavy that he can't lift it himself?
So what do you think? What's the answer?
Well, if he can or can't, it doesn't matter. It limits him.
So the answer would be that he could create it, but after he created it, he would also be able to lift it. That would be the answer according to everything we're studying. Yes?
So if I'm reading a text in Russian, I can quickly understand that Russian is not my language. I could give up saying I don't understand, or I can call someone who understands Russian and get a definition. I think that we are trying to understand God by using the logic, when maybe it's an invitation to understand God in a different level, which is not the rational one. And that's what I would like to see how it can be discussed, because maybe we keep solving a problem that cannot be solved in the way that we're trying to solve it. We should have another help. That's maybe the emotional level. Is that where we're going?
I wouldn't say emotional, but I would say with faith.
Oh, with faith. Well, the same. Different approach. That's what
correct. Yes. Ultimately, our relationship with God, the bedrock of our relationship is faith. But we also have a commandment that we have to use our mind to try to pursue and understand to the extent possible. Then even wherever we fall short of being able to actually grasp God, then beyond that, we go with faith. So wherever our mind can't stretch, wherever it stretches until beyond that, there's only one way to take it. And that is with faith. But In the meantime, we're going to try to understand a little bit more. So once we establish this term, that you can't ascribe any impossibility to God, which means he's nimna hanimnaot, we're going to find an actual manifestation of this, something that defies logic, that actually existed within reality in the temple. So we all know that there were various degrees of holiness as far as the spaces and chambers within the temple, starting from outside of Israel, Jerusalem, the Temple Mount, etc., etc. The 10th and highest level of sanctity was the inner chamber called the Holy of Holies, in Hebrew called the Kodesh HaKadashim. Now, the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, entered the space only one day a year. Which day? On Yom Kippur. And that's what this space was reserved for. What was inside this room? The Holy Ark. And this is basically what it looked like. And in this ark were the tablets. Now, this room was 20 cubits. If you measured it from wall to wall, it would be 20 cubits, which is roughly 30 feet. And that was 20 by 20. Now, in the middle of the room sat the ark. The ark was 2.5 cubits wide. And this is what happened. If you walked into the Holy of Holies with a tape measure, I wouldn't suggest trying walking in there with a tape measure, but if you did, this is what would happen. If you would measure from one wall to the other wall, it would measure 20 cubits. If you measured from one wall until one side of the ark, it would be 10. And if you measured from the other wall until the ark, it would also be 10. Even though the ark itself was 2.5 cubits. So if you went from one side till the ark, how much should it have been? 8.7.5. So that's what it should have been if you measured from one wall until the ark began.
So it didn't occupy any space.
So it didn't occupy any space. It occupied space and didn't occupy space at the same time. It occupied space because it actually measured 2.5 cubits. But it also didn't occupy space, because if you measured from the wall until the ark, you would get 10 cubits. So this was a physical manifestation of God, of the essence of God, literally being present in this room, in that room, in the Holy of Holies. And by the way, I'm not going to get into this at length, but being that we're starting Hanukkah this Thursday night, we light the menorah. So we're all aware of the miracle of the oil, that only enough oil to last for one day is all they had. They found one jug of oil, and it miraculously lasted 8 days till they were able to make new oil. What exactly happened here? What happened was, and this, I'm not going to, like I said, I'm not going to get into it, but what happened here was, is that the oil was being consumed and not being consumed simultaneously. Because the oil, if you would walk into the temple while the oil, while this menorah was burning, it's a whole Talmudic debate exactly how the oil was diminished, which I'm not going to get into the depth of it right now. But the point is think of the burning bush. The burning bush was the same thing. The verse says that the bush was on fire, but it wasn't being consumed. That is the same concept, the same manifestation of something impossible to us actually existing within our reality. Something burning but not being consumed. So
when we rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, is the same phenomenon going to occur?
If it's a real temple, then absolutely. And it's going to be real, because we're not going to build it until we know it's for real. So yes, that's really what defines the space and the sanctity of the space. So the point here is that when it comes to the essence of God, it transcends everything. It's not bound to the infinite. All the rules are suspended when it comes to the essence of God. The infinite and the finite are both suspended when it comes to the essence. Okay. So, figure 6.3, this is the third idea when it comes to the essence. Follows no rules whatsoever. It is the source of all rules. Now, it seems a little bit, maybe irrelevant, what we're saying till now. Maybe it's just, you know, for the sake of philosophizing. However, there's a very relevant application to this fact that the essence of God is beyond any rules whatsoever. And here is something fascinating. Because there are rules of physics, there's rules of nature, there's rules of morality. We all know that there are things that are good, there are things that are evil. And our world contains both. So here's something fascinating. That when it comes to Atzmut, when it comes to the essence of God is beyond all of these rules. And not just the rules of nature. Even the rules of good and evil. And we'll read a fascinating text from the Midrash, which gives us this idea. Michael, would you like to read? Yes, please, on 186.
From the start of the universe's creation, God foresaw the deeds of the righteous and the deeds of the wicked, as it is stated. God knows the ways of the righteous and the way of the wicked that is doomed. This was represented at the start of creation as follows. The earth was chaotic and desolate. This refers to the deeds of the wicked. God said, "Let there be light." This refers to the deeds of the righteous. However, the narrative has yet to clarify the genre of deeds that God desires. Is it these or those? This is clarified in the following verse. God saw that the light was good. Clearly, God desires the deeds of the righteous and does not desire the deeds of the wicked.
Fascinating. So we're saying that God himself, Atzmut, really had the ability to choose the deeds of the wicked. In other words, good and evil itself was decided by God. All rules were decided by God. So God decided what's going to be good and what's going to be evil. So nonetheless, even though he did make those rules and created those rules as we know them, he could have also chosen otherwise. I mean, say for example, we're all aware of the story of the binding of Isaac, where God tells Abraham to bring up his son as an offering. And of course, before he does it, tells him not to, and it's something that's totally outruled. But in theory, now we're used to that, so in our minds, human sacrifice is unheard of, and it would be something that we wouldn't be able to fathom. But theoretically speaking, God could have written different rules, and what's evil to us would have been identified as good. Make sense? Okay. So God is really literally started from a blank paper, and everything that exists, including the difference between good and evil, everything was originated and created by God, and to the extent that it could have also been otherwise. In other words, it's the ultimate free choice. When we say that we have free choice, and we'll come back to that shortly, it all originates within God. God really had free choice, and free choice, what is the definition of free choice? Free choice means
more than one.
More than one what?
Anything. If you have to choose, you have more than one.
Yes, but that just choosing between two things is not yet choice. In other words, if you go to a car dealership and they have five different kinds of cars and you choose one of the five different brands, that's not free choice. You're choosing the one that you're choosing because you're compelled to. There's something about that car, certain features about that car that the other four don't have. That one does have it, and that's why I'm choosing it. So that's not free choice. Most of our choices that we make are not considered free choice. We're compelled to make that choice because of something. To keep it really simple, if I just want to have a fruit and I go to the refrigerator and I see an apple and an orange, and I take one of them, that's not free choice. I took the one that I was in the mood of, and my mood compelled me to choose the one that I did. What would be absolute free choice if there were two apples in the refrigerator that were identical in shape, in color, in everything? There was nothing about one versus the other that had any feature that should compel me to choose it more than the other one. That would be actual free choice. When I'm not being compelled to choose something more than something else, that is free choice. And that is what God started everything with. He could have chosen what we know as evil to be good, but he chose what we know as good to be good and what we know as evil to be evil. That's because real free choice exists only within God's essence. So, for example, if you're going back to the car dealership, so what after you tell the salesman exactly what you're looking for in your car and all the features, and if you want it half loaded or fully loaded or not loaded at all, and the color, and you describe everything that you want. And then they tell you right there on that row in the lot, there's three of them that fit exactly your description. And you walk over there and you look at these three cars and they are actually identical. And you don't even know which one to choose. Now you're totally lost. Because maybe one's a little different or better than the other, but the truth is they're all identical. Choosing one of those, that will be free choice. But if you inspect them and you find a scratch on the tire of one of them and that's why you choose the other one, that you just lost your free choice. Because there's something that's pulling you to one versus the other. So, talking about God, first of all, this term, Bechira Chafshit, is a choice that originates completely from within the chooser and is not compelled, even in the slightest, by any external consideration. So when we're choosing good and evil, it's because, hopefully, we're choosing between good and evil, and we're choosing good, that's because it's good. So we're obviously compelled to make the right decision. But when God made these choices, he could have went any direction that he wanted. That's what it means, that in the essence of it all, he's beyond, transcends everything, transcends all the rules, to the extent that he could have went any direction he wanted. Any questions or comments on this?
It's really beyond our comprehension.
It is. We're just dabbling in Atzmut a little bit. But we're not really, we can't really understand the essence with our minds.
Our faith connects us to God. And that gives us a little bit of clarity that doesn't have expression and definition, whatever.
I have a couple of comments. That's deep. And it's...
I warned you in the beginning of tonight.
And it's kind of scary. Is it? Do you know why that might be?
What's the scary part?
That, I guess because I can't get a real handle on... I mean, things that you're bringing up, they keep changing. Not the things that you're bringing up necessarily, but maybe my ideas about what I thought are changing. And it's kind of scary.
Look, once, if you work in a company and the boss decided that the workday in this company is going to be from 8 to 4 instead of 9 to 5, so then whoever works there is going to be following those rules that the boss put in place. The boss could have made it 9 to 5, or he could have made it 8 to 4. He could have chose either one, but once he chose one of them, then whoever works there is going to have to honor that. Otherwise, you're going to have to find a different company to work for. So similarly, once God put all the rules in place, that's what we follow, and that's what we know as to be the rules. But that doesn't mean he couldn't have made them differently. He absolutely could have. Okay, let's advance with this idea a little more, because it actually has some very powerful real life, not just lesson, but relevance. So where does this, how does this apply to our daily lives? So it's not just that the essence, Atzmut, transcended these rules in the beginning of creation when God set these rules in place. We actually have an example where God remains transcendent. He remains above all of these rules, even now. And it actually relates to us in a very direct way, and that is when it comes to the idea of teshuva. You know what teshuva means?
Return
or repentance, whatever term you want to use. And we have the ability to repent even after we may have done something that we shouldn't have. We could repent, we can repair things, we can gain atonement and forgiveness, even if we messed up and did things that were undesirable to God. And God forgives and atones. As we say in text number 5, actually from Maimonides, Zelina, would you like to read this one, please? Thank you. Very powerful words from Maimonides. Even if somebody lived their whole life, they violated God's will until they were 80 years old, and on their last day, they repented and returned to God in sincerity, they have a portion in the world to come, and they go to heaven. The question is, how is it that a person could do that? They can thoroughly disregard the will of God for decades and decades, and then God actually, as long as they repent at the last moment, God actually forgives them. How does that work? So let's go to 6. Yoav, please.
Violation of the divine will are felt most keenly by the divine author who escaped that will. On the other hand, God transcends his own will and is not compelled to react to violation in a particular way, for who can tell him, what are you doing? Ecclesiastes. For consequently, through Teshuvah, which is loftier than all of the mitzvot, and which touch the innermost depth of God's desire, one can obtain atonement.
Thank you. So here's something fascinating about Teshuvah. What's happening here? Let's go back to the company for a minute. If somebody in the company violates the will of the company policy, who's most bothered by it? Is it the middle management, upper management, or the boss himself? The boss is the one that's the most bothered when policy is broken by an individual. He's the most hurt. Yet, who in the company is able to forgive the individual for what they did? Only the boss. So it's the one who's most hurt. He's the one who is empowered to grant clemency to that individual who violated the policy. It's the same boss. And this is really what we're learning here about God. So we're saying that who's the one that's bothered when somebody violates? Of course, it's God. God wrote the rules and he gave us a purpose and mission in life. And when we do something that's not aligned with his will, so he's the boss, so to speak, that's hurt by it. But when we return to God and repent for what we did, where does the forgiveness come from? From God himself. In other words, it takes the essence of God. This is where we see where the essence, where on this level of Atzmut, where God transcends the rules, he is also able, he forgives us, because even in the present, he also is beyond the rules. So in other words, when we return to God with sincerity, and we mean it, what's really happening here? So if we broke a rule, why is God even looking beyond what we did? If we did something wrong, we did something wrong. We got to pay. However, when we repent, repentance basically is, and we're talking about the sincere repentance. I mean, think about a parent and child, or Any type of relationship, parent and child, is an obvious one. So let's say there's certain rules in the home, and rules need to be followed. What happens, and only if you follow the rules, let's say, you get your ice cream if you're in pajamas at 7:30 p.m., let's just say. What if he or she is not in pajamas at 7:30 and it took till 8:30, but they still want the ice cream? So chances are, there's a very good chance that they're going to approach the parent and climb up on his or her lap and give them a big hug and say, could I please have the ice cream anyway? And there's a very good chance that they may get the ice cream anyway. But what happened there? Does this mean that it's all a joke? Does it mean that there's no rules and it's just all a game? Not at all. What happens is that there are rules and there are policies in the home. And yes, they were violated. But what's happening now? What's the child doing by giving the parent that hug? What he's really doing, he or she, is digging a little bit deeper and uncovering a deeper dimension to that relationship. Yes, if the relationship would be viewed just from the same perspective, then you broke the law or you didn't follow orders and you don't get it. But if they're able to uncover a deeper dimension to the relationship, in other words, there's the relationship on the level of where the laws exist. Just like between God and the Jewish people, He gave us a Torah, there's a book of laws, and that we're supposed to live a life that reflects these laws. Now, if we break one, then whatever, there's a program. There's checks and balances within the Torah too. So why did God create something called Yom Kippur? If there's laws and there's checks and balances and whatever there is, and reward and punishment, etc., why are you giving us this mechanism even called Teshuvah? If you did something wrong, you got to pay. That's because the relationship between us and God is multidimensional, as we'll see. The soul actually has 5 different levels. Anyone familiar with this? Anyone know any of the names?
Nefesh.
Ruach.
Neshama. Is it on the wall somewhere? Just kidding. Excellent. Anything else? Chaya. Number 4. And number 5 is Yechida. So Atzmut can transcend his own will and offer atonement when we do teshuva. Let's just explain how this works. So we're kind of coming back to the build up here, but I don't want to derail where we were. Let's just get to the objective of what we're trying to say here. So we had the parallel of the divine versus the human, but the real core of everything on the human side is called Yechida. Level number 5 is called Yechida. Literally, it means the united one. That's what the word means, Yachid. But what it means is, in the context of the soul, it's the essence of the soul that is, how do you say that word?
Inexorable.
Yes, united with God. Where it is one and not possible to detach. That's what the level of Yechida is. So when we talk about Teshuvah or Yom Kippur, and I'm not going to get carried away with Yom Kippur here, but just one point. Why do we have this? Why is it kind of built into the system? God gave us a day in the year to repent. He gave us this mechanism called Tshuva, which we can do any day of the year, actually. And in fact, the reason why on Yom Kippur we pray 5 times, the only day of the year. A regular day, it's 3 times. Shacharit, Mincha, Arvit. On Shabbat and holidays, we add a 4th. That's called Musaf. One day a year, on Yom Kippur, we add a 5th. That's called Ne'ilah. Why is that? Because Ne'ilah corresponds to this 5th level of the soul. On the day of Yom Kippur, we access the deepest part of ourselves. We uncover that dimension within the relationship between us and God. And on that level, it transcends everything. Anything, the love, like the parent-child relationship that transcends any violation of any rule, that's what Yechida is defined by. When it comes to this level of Yechida, we are one with God, and regardless of what one may have done throughout their entire life, that place remains absolutely intact, pure, innocent, and pristine. And when we reveal that component to the relationship, then God totally transcends any rules that we may have broken. Let's just read this text in 7, and then I'll take a question. Joseph, please, on 191.
Together the Jewish people and God form one complete entity, so to speak. This is due to the bond between the very essence of the soul and God's essence. By contrast, while the soul's various expressions and powers also enjoy a relationship with God, the relationship is susceptible to damage as a consequence of the person's choices. The soul's essence is always intimately bound and united with God, in the unity that our sages depicted, merged and bonded with you in a oneness to be one with you.
Thank you, thank you. So, if somebody is living a corrupt lifestyle, let's just say, what moves them to turn, to repent, and return to God, if they're not really in that place?
Yirah.
What's that?
Yirah.
Fear? Well, if they apparently they have no fear of God, because that's why they were living the life that they were.
But they could later on develop yirah.
They could develop yirah, but what would snap them out of the life that they're living, and so to speak, wake them up? I mean, that's an event, a particular event that may compel them, and that's, you know, something, a life event could do that. But it could also happen without something external. It could also come from within. But it wouldn't come from a regular emotion like fear. Because if they had it, if it was around, then where was it all this time?
Emptiness.
Okay, that would be...
Like, you know, one of the things that you mentioned is, seems like we have a purpose and a mission. Many times when you feel like you don't have a mission and a purpose, that causes emptiness. Make you rethink, what are you doing, where are you going?
Yeah, you can come to a certain point in life and start reflecting on, like, where's all this taking me? But and that's all correct. But
so is it the ultimate connection that we have to God? When the soul is connected to God?
Yechida is that fifth level, and that connection is always intact. Regardless of what we do to the other four levels, we may abuse all of the other four levels of the relationship. But regardless, that fifth level remains untouched. Nothing that somebody could do, even the worst choices that they make, can't taint that level number 5. It's always alive and well. And that's why what moves somebody to teshuva, and you're right, it could be a lot of things, and it could be events in life or whatever, but ultimately, if somebody is aroused to return to God, it's coming from that level, because something got them in touch with that level. Yes, it may be an event in life made them become aware of that dimension to the relationship. But when they show, when they express, when that individual expresses his or her yechida toward God, then God reciprocates and also suspends and overlooks all the rules. Yes, we may have broken some, or more, but nonetheless, God overlooks all of that and forgives and atones, because He too is reciprocating and looking from a much deeper perspective in the relationship.
So if a person goes to the grave without tshuva, does the soul get fragmented and your feet goes to heaven and the rest what in the ground?
Well, the soul has to go through cleansing. All of the soul has to go through cleansing. The yechida doesn't need cleansing because it never got dirty.
Right.
The other components of the soul need cleansing in order to be able to enter heaven. So almost all souls ultimately enter heaven. The question is what kind of process of cleansing they have to go through. So for the most part, what's known as hell in other religions doesn't really exist in Judaism.
It's just a cleansing.
They view it as a destination where you just go and you stay there. We don't have that. We have a process, a cleansing process. Think of it as a washing machine. And why? Because the soul has to return to God and go to heaven. And it will. However, it just needs to go through that process of cleansing and removing the schmutz and the dirt that got collected to the soul, that gathered on the soul throughout our time here while it was in a body. Once that's done, it's ready to enter heaven, which is why we say Kaddish, but that's a different conversation.
Is that why we say Kaddish every day for 11 months?
Correct.
Okay.
The reason why we say for 11 months is, first of all, the longest that a soul can be busy being cleansed before entering heaven is 12 months. Okay. But we say Kaddish for 11 only, because we stop 1 month early, because basically all of our loved ones across the board, for everybody, we stop at 11 months, because we don't want to suggest that anyone that we knew actually needed the full 12 months to be able to get to heaven. So we stop short a month in advance. But it could also take a month or two or three, and the soul is already in heaven. But anyway.
Two questions. One, inexorably united with God, is that similar, related to, the same as devakut?
Devakut? Yeah, we use that word. Chavuka o dvukabach, the last line of the text, we use that word, actually, of text 7.
I didn't look at the Hebrew. Thank you. The first question I had to do with, does God have to accept teshuvah? Could a pharaoh or a Hitler have tried to make teshuva, and would God have said, sorry, but you can't?
First of all, these are big ones. Second of all, what God would do, we don't know.
Have souls.
We can't speak for God. Number three, there are certain people who have reached a level of evil that they can't be on the streets. Now, once they aren't, and other people are safe from being in harm's way, then could they reach a full atonement? As far as Torah is concerned, it seems that almost anybody would be a very extreme exception for someone who their teshuvah would not be welcome. Now, it doesn't mean that they didn't do harm, and there's other components to it, but as far as a real sincere regret for what they did, is that possible with almost anybody? The Torah's perspective is that yes.
How is that different, other than the timing, with Christian absolution?
Do I look like a Christian theologian?
I don't either. I don't have that answer.
You hit the wall.
I can't speak for other religions, but I'm not sure what the question is.
The theory behind Christian absolution is that you can admit your faith in God or God through Jesus at the end of your life and still be accepted into the world to come. All right? We say it's going to take some time and some process other than just snapping your fingers.
I mean, that's not teshuvah. Teshuvah means real inner, internal work. It's internal work. And outside of it being the last day of someone's life, they also have to prove that they meant it. If we want to do teshuvah and we're changing, we need to change our ways. Yes, doing it on their deathbed is an exception to the rule. Over there, it's too late to change their ways, but God still accepts their sincere regret. But for the rest of us, the test of how sincere our teshuva is what is tomorrow going to look like. So if we change our ways, and it's not easy to do that, then we know it was for real. Yes.
This teshuva, it's about your action. How much is faith? That's maybe the difference, like, in Christianity. I mean, faith is a really big component of that acceptance. If you're a good person, but your faith is not there, but you're doing the good deeds and you're having a life, is that...
God judges our actions.
Right.
Jews are known to struggle with faith, and there's nothing wrong with struggling with faith.
Sure.
Moses also did, and so did Abraham. They questioned. And there's nothing wrong with struggling with faith.
God gives us 42 struggles.
As long as we're still doing what we need to do, even while we're struggling with faith, there's nothing wrong with that. Okay, so let's kind of sum all this up. And then we'll continue after it with the last section. Where are we? Yes, so we dealt with the five levels of the soul, nefesh, ruach, neshama, chaya, yechida, and we spoke about the relationship between the deepest part of the human soul, which is yechida, and God reciprocates and forgives and transcends the rules, even when somebody broke the rules. Atzmut is connected to and parallels the deepest part of the souls that we said. We'll get a good summary on this video.
Welcome to our final episode on the world of Kabbalah. The mystical system stretches like a ladder. In our first episode, we began at its lowest rung and we climbed upward from there. So, before we hit the climax, let's recap our previous steps. Lesson 1. We met the three basic layers of God's creation that range from terra firma to the spiritual extreme. Kabbalists call them three worlds of created entities, Asiya, Yetzirah, and Bria. What do they have in common? They sense their own identity, and they feel independent from God. We can relate to that all too well. Lesson 2. We rose beyond creation to meet the divine world of Atzilut, home to the Sefirot. The divinity of Atzilut is stamped with the limitations of defined characteristics. We cannot relate to such powerful divinity, but we can connect with its variety of characteristics. Lesson 3. We soared beyond Atzilut to meet Keter. That's a leap from divinity with limitations to God's infinite light. It's difficult for us to relate to God's infinity, but we learned why the infinite light is indispensable for our limited world. Lesson 4. We hit the peak of our ladder and discovered a debris field of a cosmic mystical explosion. During the pre-birth of creation, the intense but chaotic spiritual layer known as Tohu imploded, the effects of which still impact our reality today. Lesson 5. We met the ultimate mystery of creation. How does anything but infinity emerge from God's infinite light? That's where we discovered Tzimtzum, the cosmic process of contracting and concealing divine light to facilitate the emergence of all layers of existence. That was some ride. So, what's missing? Well, we've discussed God's creation, its system, purpose, and relevance. We've also discussed God's transcendent divinity. But we haven't discussed God himself. There's a reason for that. God is off the charts. We plotted a path from the foot of the mystical system, that's us, all the way to the greatest divine revelation. But God's self, or Atzmut, the essence, that's beyond any revelation, description, or definition. God transcends all logic and rules, which are merely his own creations. So here's today's surprise. That's exactly what makes God himself most relevant. Why is that? Here's one reason. God designed us in his own image, which means that he gave us the ability, not provided to the rest of the rule-abiding system, to break the divine rules. And we do. We mess up. But where do we go from there? The system works by the book. We threw out the book, so the system won't let us back in. Thankfully, God himself, at his essence, is not bound by the rules he authored. He is free to revise or override at will. And God chose to connect our deepest core, the very essence of our soul, to his own essence. How does that help us? Because our desire to repair our relationship with God after messing up springs from our deepest self. It's the voice of our innermost soul. So when we reach into our deepest self to return to God's embrace, God does the same. He overrides his own system to provide us clemency and atonement. Our sincerity cuts through the cosmos, and God's reciprocating love cuts through his infinite light, the Tzimtzum, Tohu, Keter, Atzilut, Bria, Yetzirah, and Asiya, to us. Now, if that's not absolutely relevant, nothing is.
Okay. So, with the little bit of time we have left, a few additional ideas, perhaps as mind-blowing or mind-twisting as some of the ones that we just discussed tonight already. So, let's see. So, here's the remarkable thing. We talk about the essence of God, as our fellow on the screen just mentioned, that what's remarkable is that in this deepest part of God, in this essence of God, the most relevant aspect to all of creation when it comes to the essence of God is the essence of us right here. We are the objective of the entire creation. That is what's so remarkable. So even though we're talking about the essence of God that defies every description, but nonetheless, the objective is that what's most relevant is what's happening right here below in this world. So why is that? So first of all, Hasidic philosophy points out that we share a common quality with the essence of God. And here's what it is. We're not going to read the whole text number 8. I'll just read the first paragraph of text number 8. The difference between the upper spiritual worlds and the material world of ours is that only the inhabitants of our material world experience their existence as entirely independent of any source. Here's what's fascinating. We said the whole evening that God is the essence of it all, is beyond everything. Everything else exists because of Him. He exists absolutely. There's one other entity in all of existence that has a similar feeling, a feeling of I am the be-all and end-all of everything. I don't come from anywhere. I'm independent. I have everything going for myself. I don't know who I came from. I don't even know if I came from anybody. And who is that?
Self.
The self. Sounds familiar? Only the human being has a similar perception like the essence of God. The essence of God truly doesn't come from anywhere, is the ultimate existence, doesn't need anybody or anything because it always existed and always will. The only other entity in all of creation that has such feelings and sentiments is the human being. The human being is able to convince themselves that they come from themselves and nobody and there's no God. I've met people that tell me that they don't believe in God. They're not even sure if God exists. In other words, they exist because they exist. Just like God does. So because of that, this component is very telling. And the only reason why the human could have such a perception is because we are bound up with the essence of God. So it's not by mistake that we have such a perception. It could come across as foolish when somebody says they don't believe in God, etc. We could use it for the wrong reason. But the reason why it's even possible for someone to have this perception is because at the core we really are one with the essence of God, more than any other creation. No one else has such an idea, only we do. And that's because we actually come from there. We're bound up directly and deeply with the essence of God. Now, what's unique about the world that we live in is, so there's a term which, I'm not sure if we touched upon this term yet, right here, yesh me'ayin, which means something from nothing. When we talk about this world and how it was created, we talk about it being something from nothing, because nothing existed, and God created it. So it's something, now it's a something. You look around, you see this, it's a something. Where did it come from? Nothing. But that's a little strange. We're saying that everything comes from God, so we're calling God nothing. But we are really something. Does that make sense? We are the real something, but we were created by God and we identify God as nothing. The opposite would be the real truth. What are we? We're just dependent on God. We're here because God put us here and is giving us life right now. Otherwise, we wouldn't exist. So we're the nothings. Who's the real something? The real something should be God, who actually is capable of something. He actually created the world. He created us. So to describe this reality, we should say that it's nothing from something. Why do we call it something from nothing? So it depends whose perspective it is. Where are we in the readings? Yes, please. Text number 9.
The created entity is considered like nothing before him, meaning that it has no independent existence and is therefore utterly nullified before God. Nevertheless, that is only before him and God's perception, as meaning the truth is available exclusively above. However, the perception from below, i.e. the created being's perception, is that it is an entirely independent creation. This is because the energy that flows into not understood or experienced by the entity at all. This is why we refer to creation as something from nothing.
Thank you. So it depends whose perspective you're looking from. The real truth, the true perspective is when you're looking from above, from God's perspective, that God is the real something, and what he created is like a nothing. It's barely anything. That's the real perspective. However, our perspective is that we're something. We have everything going for ourselves, but we come from nothing. Now, why do we even have this perspective? Why is it possible for us to have this perspective? Why don't we have God's perspective that we're nothings and God is everything, God's something? And the answer is because God wanted it precisely to be this way. God wanted to create a reality with human beings who convince themselves that they are some things, and they don't even have a source. They don't even know their source. They don't know where they come from. They're not even sure if there is a God. They can convince themselves that there isn't. God wanted humans who are capable of such a perspective, and yet, even though they're that distant, and they're so self-centered, and they so don't. They don't have a clear perspective that there even is a God or of God. And nonetheless, God wanted creations of that nature to choose him. God wanted the most distant possible type of creature to exist, and that type of creature should choose God. As long as it's one of the other levels, let's say angels. Angels have a concept of God. So when they choose God, it's not so impressive. And the same is with the various levels of angels in all the three worlds above ours. But to create an entity that is so convinced that they have everything going for themselves, that they call themselves something and God nothing, in other words, they're so distant and they're so detached, that is exactly what God wanted to create. And that type of being should then go seek out God. What are we all doing in this room? I believe everybody ultimately is here because we're seeking out God. Instead of sitting on our couch watching TV or whatever, we took the time, the energy, and the focus to spend, to exert ourselves to seek out a relationship with God. Every time we do anything positive or a mitzvah or study or prayer, we're doing the same thing. And that is the value that God was looking for. But he couldn't have the truest value comes only when he created the specific type of creation that we are, where we can call ourselves something and our source nothing. Now we're in business. Now when humans like this choose God, that is valuable. That is exactly, precisely the relationship that God was looking for. Yes.
Well, I think that's what you mentioned, I think, 5 weeks ago, right, that is similar to how we raise a kid, right, that we foster independency with the hope or the goal that eventually we will build the true relationship of love, not based on dependency.
Exactly, exactly. So what you're doing now is actually exactly what the text, that one-line text, that text number 12, which... it now has a double meaning. What it means in the textbook, the end is wedged in the beginning, and the beginning in the end, which is a famous Kabbalistic idea. We also actually say such words in Lecha Dodi on Friday night. You may be familiar with the words Sof Ma'aseh B'Machshava Tchila, which means the same thing, that the end game, whatever happens in the end, was actually in the original perception. That means the end game, which is us in this lowest world, this was what God had in mind when he went into the whole business of creation. It was the ultimate last piece in the puzzle, which is what triggered the purpose and the vision for all of creation, is this world and us in this world. That's what God had in mind. But what Yoav just did was connect the beginning and end of the course. We started with that idea, but that's precisely the idea. The idea is that God first created entities that he had a closer, more commonality with in the upper worlds, and then angels. And just like we use the analogy when it comes to educating a child, it starts with closeness, but then eventually you want to see independence. And then you foster a relationship when you're an adult and you choose a relationship with the parent. That's the most valuable. When you're not compelled to do it, you're not doing it because you're coming for money or for anything else, you're doing it because you actually appreciate the relationship with the parent. That is where it's at. So similarly here, it's the ultimate, the lowest component in this whole map that we have right here, the very bottom of it, which is us in the physical world of Asiya. God had precisely this in mind when the concept came up, so to speak, in his own mind, to create the worlds. And what's the purpose of it all? The purpose of it all is, just like anybody here who invests in one way or another, you don't invest $100 so that at the end of the day you should be able to take out $100. Why did God bother with this whole business? Why did God, if all of the universe first was filled with God's light, and then he contracted himself and removed it just to shine the same light back in? Why did God create all these worlds? There has to be something more, greater than what he put in that was going to come out of it. So just to have the same thing as what he started with would be a waste of time. What is the return on his investment that he was looking for? That we should be here. We should be here. He gave us the Torah. And when we make choices every day of our life, every hour and every minute, to live a godly life, and when we eat, we bring God into our meals, and we try to eat kosher as much as we can, and we eat purposefully and mindfully, and when we do exercise, it's for the purpose of having a healthy body so that we can serve God. And we prioritize and bring God into our life and bring God into our home, whether it's a mezuzah or a Shabbat candle or observing Shabbat or a Friday night or a Kiddush, whatever component it is, one little bit more today than we did yesterday. When we make that choice, we are actually fulfilling the entire purpose of creation. This is exactly why God created the world and created this whole system, this whole complicated system that we studied over the last 6 weeks. The ultimate is that we should be here and make a decision to do something more godly in this physical world, and that actually fulfills the very purpose of why God created the world in the first place. And that's item number 8 in figure 6.8 on 204. God desires a home in this physical world, and that's why we are here. So, just to close out this wonderful course, if you'll join me on page 210, maybe we'll do a little exercise together instead of individually. We'll have a little bit of fun, and then we will close out the course. Concluding exercise, match each of the following human features with its corresponding layer of existence within the mystical system of devolution. So I'm going to call out something, and you'll call out the answer. So each one has something that it corresponds to on the other column. So we'll start with the 10 attributes. Which word on the right side is aligned with the 10 attributes? Sfirot, correct. Which one is thought? Machshava. Bria, yes, the first of the three worlds. Excellent. Which one is aligned with action? Asiya, that was an easy one. Which one is speech? Yetzira, which one is desire, ratzon? That should be aligned with Or Ein Sof, otherwise known as Keter. Maybe it should have said Keter there in parentheses. And then we have soul essence. Atzmut, the top one, that's the essence of the soul. Yechida is aligned with the essence of God. And the final one, the animal soul, where do we say it originates? In the world of Tohu. You guys are experts. Thank you all for joining. I had a great time. I hope you did as well. And our next course, by the way, very different in nature from this course, will begin at the end of January, beginning of February. And it's called Advice for Life. If this one was very esoteric, the next course is going to be extremely down-to-earth and practical. And it's going to explore six different areas within our lives, like family, health, work, etc., all in the light of the teachings of the Lubavitch Rebbe, because he dispensed advice to literally thousands and maybe tens of thousands of people over a span of 4 or 5 decades. And it's going to be through the lens of his teachings that we're going to discover all of these great ideas. It's in advance of commemorating his 30th Yahrzeit, which will be in June, which is the reason for this course this year. So stay tuned. And I look forward to continuing the journey of learning together with you. Thank you. Thank you.